Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today is Magna Carta Day, the Great Charter's 802nd birthday. Anybody familiar with the immortal legend of Robin Hood, who robbed from the rich and gave to the poor, knows about evil Prince John, and perhaps might also remember when he was king after the death of his brother Richard the Lionheart, his angry barons forced him to concede a few essential rights and liberties, or they would impeach him 13th century style. Considered the most famous document of British constitutional history, the Magna Carta was issued by King John at Runnymede under compulsion from the barons and the church on June 15, 1215. After being crowned king, John returned to his old wicked ways and incurred general acrimony from his expensive and unsuccessful foreign wars, financing them by levying heavy taxes on the baronage and peasantry, charging excessively for royal justice, selling church offices to whomever had the requisite coin, and seizing property from those lax in taxes. In 1215, the peers of the realm rose in rebellion and, faced by irresistible wrath, John parleyed with the barons at Runnymede. After some attempts at evasion, he set his seal to the barons' demands, and the resulting document was proclaimed a charter freely granted, although its guarantees were actually extorted by the angry peerage. In reality, the charter was in most respects a reactionary document. It ensured feudal rights and privileges to only the nobility and the church, from which the king could not renege. Yet the charter definitely implies that there are laws protecting the rights of subjects and communities the king was bound to observe, and penalties if he failed to observe them. In other words, English kings and queens were no longer above the law. Historically, most important were vaguely worded statements against oppression of all subjects, which later generations interpreted as guarantees of trial by jury and habeas corpus. These interpretations were not explicit in the charter, but eventually became laws of the land. The Magna Carta did not prevent civil war that year of 1215, and quite likely was a cause, nor did it end antagonism between Normans and Saxons that had festered since the invasion of 1066, but it began a sense of commonality between aristocracy and proletariat. The Magna Carta must be considered a midway point between Solon's Athenian constitution of the 6th century BC and the U.S. Constitution. With most of the land and political power in the hands of Athenian nobility and the peasants not only losing their land, but freedom as well, being sold into slavery for debts, there was a great deal of social, economic, and political stress in Athens during the late 6th century BC, or BCE, before Common Era. In desperation, Solon, a successful soldier and what now would be considered a lawyer, was called upon all stratas of Athenian society to draw up a constitution. He made important constitutional changes on the side of humanitarian ideas and opened the city's assembly to all free men, though not women. That took another 3 millennia for women anywhere to have constitutional rights. He ended all borrowing in which a person's liberty might be pledged, which put an end to serfdom in Athens and its province of Attica, but not the residual slavery of Greece, which, like the rest of civilized antiquity, depended upon slavery as its machinery. Solon's relatively humane code was a great contrast to the onerous code it replaced of the dictator Draco, whose name continues to personify cruel legislation on a par with the Spanish Inquisition's Torquemada of the 15th century AD, or CE, Common Era. Draco's draconian legal code was quite simple. The penalty of death was applied to even the most trivial offenses. Perhaps his single quantum reform was that murder was punished by the state, not by vendetta. Asked what made a good and orderly state, Solon answered, "When the people obey the rulers and the rulers obey the laws." The most significant codification of law prior to Solon was that of Hammurabi, king of Babylonia in the 18th century BC. Considered one of the greatest of ancient legal codes, it was carved on a diorite column in 3,600 lines cuneiform and was discovered at the beginning of the 20th century AD in Susa and is now preserved in Paris. Hammurabi's code addresses issues such as family and business relations, labor, private property, and personal injuries, and is generally humanitarian in aspect, although one severe feature is retributive punishment of literally an eye for an eye, which, like much of the code, was drawn from earlier Sumerian and Semitic laws and provides a hard-shell Ur text of punitive precedent. Ancient Mesopotamia's pioneering law led to the introduction of writing to codify legal charters by Elamites, Hurrians, Hittites, Sumerians, Hebrews, Babylonians. America's code of laws is based more directly upon Roman and Iroquois law than on Hammurabi or Solon, but our Constitution is essentially the direct benefactor of English law that developed from the Magna Carta. Our ancestors, as imperfect as they were, fought a revolution and conceived a constitution, as imperfect as it is, because they thought of the future. They knew very well that governments swallow the rights of their citizens and that the natural inclination of authority is to concentrate and perpetuate its power by any means. They also had the foresight to recognize that the interests and problems of succeeding generations would most certainly be different than their own. Governments reflexively subvert the rights of all but its ruling classes, even in systems originated to provide rights to the governed. Constitutional laws simply make it more difficult for leaders of government to make the rest of us so completely their subjects. This current period of trauma and crisis is precisely what our ancestral revolutionaries had in mind when they set up the imperfect but earnest Constitution and its Ten Commandments of American democracy. They anticipated critical moments of great tragedy and anxiety as now, and realized unscrupulous persons would seize the opportunity to grasp autocratic power and dismantle the Constitution. We commemorate the development of political rights and liberties over the centuries through displays and ceremonies around such documents as the Magna Carta and this year's 241st anniversary of the Declaration of Independence on July 4th. This past December 15th was the 225th anniversary of the Bill of Rights, which gives political rights to the common people and in particular protects minorities from the tyranny of majorities. But domestic politics in the USA are becoming as severe and confrontational as during the Civil War. The cultural dialogue narrows considerably, simplified into dogma and prejudices that fault subgroups for all that appears to have gone wrong, reduced to an us or them snarl. The most clamorously vile demand their vengeful fables be legislated into political veracity. In the names of freedom and justice, both are eroded, and it becomes difficult to resist an inversion that seems irreversible. The real purpose of the American experiment is that human beings are capable of coexisting as equals, that so-called free enterprise is not one of unfair or dominating advantage. A democracy is not healthy when enormous numbers of its citizens are unemployed or underpaid, with poverty and homelessness their only prospects. Perhaps the colonial rebels who declared independence from their mother country nearly 2.5 centuries ago had their own ambitious agendas, but they revived the ancient dream of living without shackles, of determining one's own life. The most famous sentiments of the Declaration of Independence virtually shout the long thwarted desires of freedom and equality, and that governments derive, quote, their just powers from the consent of the governed. Even the infamous Robespierre could a few years afterward define democracy as a state in which the people, as sovereign, guided by laws of its own making, does for itself all it can do, and by its delegates what it cannot. And Bill Moyers wrote 2 centuries later, constitutional democracy is no romantic notion. It is our defense against ourselves, the one foe that can defeat us. Yet in contrast to the premise that a constitution manifestly provides a reasonable guarantee of political equality, listen to a group of workers in Sheffield, England, whose bitterness in 1741 sounds as if they were speaking about life in the United States today. What's the Constitution to us if we are nothing to it? A newly reconstructed elite projects a constrained interpretation of the Constitution. Its rights and privileges belong to the wealthy and propertied, its dues and obligations to everyone else. They would like to suspend the Bill of Rights and believe in what they call original intent of the framers of the Constitution, who were all white propertied and or mercantile males, and that their original intent should be its only interpretation. We might, after all, be a dying democracy, a bloated red dwarf star that rose too quickly and consumes itself with careless and misguided hubris. Whatever greatness we possessed, our quest for liberty and justice for ordinary people seems to be swiftly disintegrating. The endless circle of individual rights and obligations melding within collective necessities is distinctly at play despite the strangling morass of deceit, corruption, and the sinister erosion of civil rights and liberties of average Americans. Democracy incites ever-increasing numbers despite the more than usual attempts by radical right factions to disembowel it. And despite America's own callous repression of libertarian movements abroad, covertly or overtly, the U.S. is often the model of independence sought by indigenous rebels of those same libertarian movements. The only true significance of the United States is its secular gospel of freedom of humanity from tyranny, inequality, and subjection. Our constitutional vow of liberty, equality, and justice for all is an obligation that we protect these basic rights and freedoms for our descendants. The famous American judge Learned Hand said that liberty lies in the hearts of men and women. When it dies there, no constitution, no law, no court can save it. And now, something I also wrote, a Trump eat Trump world. A couple of weeks ago, two top Trumpians, H.R. McMaster and Gary Cohn, wrote in the Wall Street Journal that their neo-Nero's sovereign embarked on his first world journey, quote, with a clear-eyed outlook that the world is not a global community but an arena where nations, non-governmental actors, and businesses engage and compete for advantage, unquote. New York Times columnist David Brooks took exception to that Trump-eat-Trump view of the world, which he wrote is the epitome of Trumpianism. It asserts that selfishness is the sole driver of human affairs, Brooks wrote, and that it grows out of a worldview that life is a competitive struggle for gain. It implies that cooperative communities are hypocritical covers for the selfish jockeying underneath. Brooks said the essay explains why the Trumpians are suspicious of cooperative global arrangements like NATO and various trade agreements, and why Trump self-styles himself like the despots he so admires, Vladimir Putin, the Saudi princes, and such other autocratic meanies as Duterte of the Philippines. And it helped explain why Trump disavows the Paris Climate Change Accord. They share Trump's core worldview that life is nakedly a selfish struggle for money and dominance, Brooks wrote. It explains why people in the Trump world, in the Trump White House, are so savage to one another, Brooks wrote. Far from being a band of brothers, their world is a vicious arena where staffers compete for advantage. McMaster and Cohen make explicit the great act of moral decoupling woven through this presidency. In this worldview, morality has nothing to do with anything. Altruism, trust, cooperation, and virtue are unaffordable luxuries in the struggle of all against all. Everything is about self-interest. Brooks disavows their disavowal. We have seen this philosophy before, he writes. Powerful, selfish people have always adopted this dirty-minded realism to justify their own selfishness. The problem is that this philosophy is based on an error about human beings, and it leads to self-destructive behavior in all cases. Brooks allows that people are driven by selfish motivations for individual status, wealth, and power. But he says that people are also motivated by other drives, such as solidarity, love, and moral fulfillment that are equally and often more powerful. And this is how Brooks views humanity. People are wired to cooperate, he writes. Far from being a flimsy thing, the desire for cooperation is the primary human evolutionary advantage we have over the other animals. People have a moral sense. They have a set of universal intuitions that help establish harmony between peoples. From their first moments, children are wired to feel each other's pain. You don't have to teach a child about fairness. They already know. People have moral emotions. They feel rage at injustice, disgust toward greed, reverence for excellence, awe before the sacred, and elevation in the face of goodness. People yearn for righteousness. They want to feel meaning and purpose in their lives, that their lives are elevated for good. People are attracted by goodness and repelled by selfishness. Brooks writes that good leaders, aware of selfish elements that drive human behavior, yet seek to inspire faithfulness by showing good character and pointing toward great ideals. But so-called realist leaders, such as Trump and his idol Putin, quote, seek to dismiss this whole moral realm. By behaving with naked selfishness toward others, they poison the common realm and force others to behave with naked selfishness toward them. They assume strife and so arouse a volley of strife against themselves. By treating the world simply as an arena for competitive advantage, Brooks writes, Trump, McMaster, and Cohn sever relationships, destroy reciprocity, erode trust, and eviscerate the sense of sympathy, friendship, and loyalty that all nations need when times get tough. By looking at nothing but immediate interest, Trump, McMaster, and Cohn turn America into a nation that affronts everybody else's moral emotions. They make our country seem disgusting in the eyes of the world, Brooks writes. And he wishes that General McMaster was a better student of Thucydides. He would know. He writes that the Athenians adopted the same immoral tone he embraces. And Brooks quotes Thucydides, "The strong do what they can, and the weak suffer what they must." As a result, Brooks writes, the Athenians ended up making endless enemies and destroying their own empire. Historian Will Durant, in his 1939 book, The Life of Greece, quotes a fuller text of Thucydides, who describes Athenian envoys demanding the surrender of the island of Melos during the Peloponnesian War. Of the gods we believe and the men we know, that by a necessary law of their nature they rule wherever they can. And it is not as if we were the first to make this law or to act upon it. We found it existing before and shall leave it to exist forever after us. All we do is make use of it, knowing that you and everybody else, having the same power as we have, would do the same as we do. With no other justification than might was right, Durant wrote, the Athenians put to death all adult males of Melos who fell into their hands, sold the women and children as slaves, and gave the island to 500 Athenian colonists. Athens rejoiced in the conquest and prepared to illustrate in a living tragedy the theme of her dramatists, that a vengeful nemesis pursues all insolent success. Custom and religion among the Greeks exercise a very modest restraint upon the victor in a war, Durant wrote in his chapter, The Morals and Manners of the Athenians. It is a regular matter, even in civil wars, to sack the conquered city, to finish off the wounded, to slaughter or enslave all unransomed prisoners, to burn down the houses, the fruit trees, and the crops, to exterminate the livestock, and to destroy the seed for future sowings. War of some kind, of city against city, or of class against class, is a normal condition in Hellas. In this way, the Greek the Greece that defeated the King of Kings, the Persian invasion in the early 5th century, turns upon itself. Greek meets Greek in 1,000 battles, and in the course of a century after Marathon, the most brilliant civilization in history consumes itself in a prolonged national suicide. An article in the latest issue of Foreign Policy magazine by Graham Allison, who is director of the Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center for Science and Industry, poses the Thucydides trap, which he writes is being precipitated, quote, as China challenges America's predominance, and that misunderstandings about each other's actions could lead them into a deadly trap, first identified by the ancient Greek historian Thucydides. As he explained, it was the rise of Athens and the fear that this installed in Sparta that made war inevitable. Allison wrote that although China's rise represents particular challenges, Washington policymakers should heed a few Cold War lessons. These are a few things he had to say. The United States and the Soviet Union built nuclear arsenals so substantial that neither could be sure of disarming the other in a first strike. Nuclear strategists describe this condition as mutual assured destruction, or MAD. Technology, in effect, made the United States and Soviet Union conjoined twins, neither able to kill the other. Today, China has developed its own robust nuclear arsenal, from confrontations in the South China Sea to the gathering storm over the Korean Peninsula. Leaders must recognize that war would be suicidal. By reaching agreements on contentious issues, the United States and China can create space to cooperate on challenges, such as global terrorism and climate change, in which the national interests the two powers share are much greater than those that divide them. Overall, leaders should understand that survival depends on caution, communication, constraints, compromise, and cooperation. Maintaining China's extraordinary economic growth, which provides legitimacy for sweeping party rule, is a high-wire act that will only get harder. Meanwhile, in the United States, sluggish growth is the new normal, and American democracy is exhibiting worrisome symptoms: declining civic engagement, institutionalized corruption, and widespread lack of trust in politics. Leaders in both nations would do well to prioritize their domestic challenges. Allison concludes that Thucydides' trap teaches us that on the historical record, war is more likely than not. Trump has accelerated the harrowing roller coaster of U.S.-China relations, Allison says. If Trump hopes to avoid catastrophic war with China while protecting and advancing American national interests, he must closely study the lessons of the Cold War. Maybe China will rise as a superior world culture this new century or the next, and the previous century recently relegated to the dustbin of history. Despite the world wars, the rise and fall of Marxist-Leninism, the birth of the nuclear age, and the rise of cyber world will be regarded as little more than a conduit toward China's future supremacy. If China does reign supreme, it will write new histories which will most likely be as ethnocentric and parochial as classic Roman narratives, or as our own perfervid chronicle of the past 2.5 centuries as America First, Manifesto Destiny Centered. Perhaps also in the words of Lafcadio Hearn, who predicted at the end of the 19th century that Asia would eventually regain supremacy in world affairs and appropriate the best Western cultures offer and discard what is useless or of little merit, we who triumphed for more than half a millennium will be missed as much as the Ichthyosaur, quote unquote. The Chinese have long recognized that the only immutable law is that everything changes. Henry Adams, at the beginning of the 20th century, later called the American century, believed the wave of change was a manifestation of a universal law of acceleration. History was speeding up, which disputably makes morality as well as technology relativist. Moral codes developed in one period are rigidly obstructionist in a succeeding era, and are usually diffused by the irresistible dynamics of humanity's swift evolution. The general procedure is periods of acceleration followed by slower periods of reflection and synthesization, which fuel newer epochs of accelerated change. Adams thought the electric dynamo made history obsolete, that the experience gained by learning and manipulating the strength of animals, wind, and water was made irrelevant by the rising mechanical electronics technology that transformed this new history into an era of energy that shows no sign of slowing down as our cyberbotic world recreates itself as speeds close to light. Humanity eternally pushes at the edge of evolution, incessantly, impatiently, and recklessly remaking the natural world into its own image. Homo sapiens sapiens races through spectrums of time we calculate and measure but little understand, propelled into every moment with impatience and hope, overturning nature's as well as our own history, regarding each as irrelevant, and perhaps the only consistency to our history is our disdain of nature, regarding the natural world in which we have spent our history as an adversary to be overcome and altered to our design, whether it be domestication of grains and animals to cloning them and ourselves for future supremacy over the entire planet. Probably nothing can stop or even detour the surge of our species except extinction, either by ourselves or inability to catch up with an expanding universe. In 1951, Margaret Mead, perhaps the preeminent anthropologist of the 20th century, made a recording for the radio program This I Believe, which was originally broadcast by CBS but has recently been reproduced by NPR. She said that a person from New Guinea has as much brain capacity to attend Harvard as someone from Boston's Beacon Hill, yet all persons become distinctly part of their home culture, whether New Guinea or Beacon Hill, which entails the necessity that distinct and alien cultures must be studied, understood, and accepted by all other cultures. She believed that humanity has barely touched its potential, and that humans are neither good or evil, but contain quantities of both, which are too often determined by culture and family. It is intrinsic in every human to love and trust, or to fear, hate, and conform, she said. Humans are builders, thinkers, seers, and prophets, creators of tools, art, and philosophy, Mead said, and that a humble but persistent study of human behavior is essential, and that humanity must realize the task of creating one world in order to keep the future safe, yet act to keep the future free. This has been Michael McCusker. In local news, the Oregon Treaty was signed today in 1846 by the U.S. and Great Britain, which established the 49th parallel as the boundary of the United States and what is now Canada, and the 12th Amendment to the Constitution, which deals with the manner of electing presidents, was ratified today, June 15, 1804, attempting to fix the mess of 1800. Now we need an amendment that enables Congress and the American people to impeach an entire administration that is corrupt, cruel, and quite possibly in league with foreign adversaries. The Trump administration fallaciously acts like old-time kings who claimed they were above law and Constitution. We failed to rectify that constitutional defect with the fake President G.W. Bush and his perfidious gang of schoolyard bullies, and now we are in a much greater muddle. Happy Magna Carta Day.